Good afternoon, and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson, and you're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM Community Radio from the ground up, coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin, in the Driftless area, southwestern Wisconsin, near the Mississippi River. And this is a show about food and lots of related topics, like where does food come from. You can listen to this show and other shows on podcast form on our archives at WDRT.org. A lot of people can't listen to our show on the radio because it only reaches about 25 miles radius, but we are on the internet. And even my dad in Arlington, Virginia, would tune in and listen to me on the internet. He figured out how to do that years ago. So today we have two guests in the studio, Lars and Henry Bergen, and we're going to talk about herding and hunting. Herding and hunting? Herding and hunting. So, you can figure out where we're going to go with this show. It probably has something to do with animals and meat, right? And how you get meat. I'm always interested in the topic of where our food comes from. How do you get your food? And do you buy it? Or there's some other way of getting your meat and other things. Do you grow a lot of it, or do you just go to the store? And how does that food get to the store? I think a lot of people don't really know how food gets to the store. You just go to the store and buy milk and buy stuff. So anyway, I'm looking forward to it. I've had Lars on my show many times. Lars always has a good topic and just a very unusual way of approaching subjects. But Lars has founded a restaurant, the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, many years ago. How many years ago now?
I think 20? It's a little more than 20.
20. And isn't that something that you can talk in decades in your life,
I
Lars?
Know.
I didn't know how you could do that, but now I can. And then Lars has been an educator and has been very influential at Youth Initiative High School over the years, very involved in community action and events and in faith, his Christian faith. So I think that we're going
Indeed,
to...
I'm going to be Jesus in the play on Friday.
Oh, now which play is this?
The Passion Play.
Who
at
puts
the
that
St.
On?
Mary's Church
at
in
St.
Viroqua.
St. Mary's Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Do they do that
PM.
Every year?
We did it last year.
Okay, now what time is that?
7 p.m. It's going to be outdoors, and the weather's looking tough, so that means I'll be able to suffer even better
so that's
in my role.
7 p.m. on Good Friday.
Mm-hmm. Good Friday, the Catholic Good Friday is this coming Friday.
Right.
Yours is a week after that.
Right, because I'm in the Orthodox practice. Right. So we're a week later this year. Not always, but this year we are. Okay, well, so add to drama. And our other guest is Henry Bergen. And are you 11, 12?
Yes, I just turned 11.
You turned 11. So he's going to be part of this show. And he's also an actor. You just finished being in Sherwood? What was the play?
Robin Hood.
It was Robin Hood. I really enjoyed that. And you played?
I played Little John.
Yeah, you did a good job.
This is a really relevant segue to our topic.
Oh, good.
Because one of the things that was most controversial in the Robin Hood stories between him and the king was who got to shoot the deer. They're referred to in the Robin Hood stories as the king's deer. And Sherwood Forest was essentially like a big game park for the king. So when Robin took one of those deer to feed his merry men, it was a crime against the king. And so that was always one of the things that they were wanting to catch Robin for doing. It wasn't just for stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, but also for killing the king's deer.
The woods belongs to the king.
Right.
And I have a very favorite movie. You might have heard of it, The Tree of the Wooden Clogs.
No.
And it's about 19th century Italy, and people were still living kind of in medieval times, and they had people that lived kind of in a compound, and they did, you know, they did the farm work for the landowner. It was really, you know, feudalism,
right,
still being practiced. And the wooden clogs thing is that the kids, you know, for their shoes, they just wore wooden clogs that were just carved out of pieces of wood. And one of the workers on the land cuts off a branch of a tree that does not belong to him. Just because he lives there doesn't mean the woods are his. Something bad happens to him because he wants to make clogs for his little boy who's outgrowing his old clogs. And same thing. I mean, that was still going on, like in, you know, 1900s, early 1900s. So anyway, yeah. So Robin Hood is really kind of pro-democracy, isn't he? Anti-king?
Yeah, pro-peasant.
Yeah, pro-peasant. Pro, yeah, common man.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting thing I've been considering a lot about, like, what are all of us doing that are, like, homesteading or like, living in the country, not really quite doing production agriculture, but it's very important to us that we produce food for ourselves. And what is that impulse and what do we call it? Because it's not the same as like farming where you're going to have 100 dairy cows and you're going to provide milk for the whole town. But it's also, it's subsistence. And it's a word that I remember being told was an indication of kind of backwardness. If you're doing subsistence farming, it means like you're
just barely scraping by.
Yeah, you can't live that way. But like, but in our farm, and we do some products for sale, mostly grass-fed beef. But the principle that we start with is always like, we should be able to make this for ourselves to a level of quality that seems really amazing, and we should be able to do almost everything for ourselves.
Well, I call that connection.
Right.
And you know what? I just watched Thoreau last night. Did you watch the Ken Burns series on Thoreau?
No, is it good?
Gosh, it was really good. And I called Anton in. He hates it when I refer to him on the radio. But anyway, we sat and watched it, and he said, you know, we studied this stuff in high school, and it kind of went over our heads. It didn't mean much to me. But, you know, Thoreau had that same idea. He wasn't going back to the land to be a farmer, or even to be somebody that just didn't participate in society anymore. But he wanted to have that connectedness. He wanted to know, how do you grow your own food? And can you live in a small building with dignity and all the things you need? And simplicity and paring down and not being bogged down by things and stuff, you know? You know, growing your own stuff and hunting is that you learn to appreciate what other people have done for you. So that when you go to the store and somebody's grown a lot of lettuce, put it in bags and brought it to the co-op or something, you go, wow, that was a lot of good lettuce, and that was a lot of harvesting, that was a lot of washing, it's all clean. You know, then you just really appreciate it, right?
Yeah, and I think about it a lot in terms of butchering, right? Because we finish probably 6 to 8 beef cattle a year. And
finish, what does that mean?
Finish means get them ready. You get them fat enough and big enough for slaughter.
Okay.
You know, so they're born on the farm, they spend 2.5 to 3 years on the farm, and then they're ready for slaughter. And we use local butchers to do that, where we'll haul them in live, and then they'll slaughter them, and then they'll cut them up for us and put them in nice packages with weights on them, and it's USDA and all that. And that's generally how we do it, because it is a ton of work. But we have butchered several of our own recently with help of the neighbors, and it really does give you tremendous gratitude for people who show up every day to cut meat. You know, it's hard work and physically demanding, and but also requires precision and skill. And so, yeah, I think that's a big part of the whole purpose behind, like, raising children this way, but also just raising yourself this way, is, like, knowing what goes into you subsisting. And it's more than just the store.
Right. And this is very timely for me, because this weekend we're slaughtering our one lamb, and she's become a pet with a name. And this is very hard.
Yeah.
And then I keep thinking, yeah, I could put her in a truck and take her someplace, but I really want her to be slaughtered on the land, not have to get in a truck and be scared and, you know, just be at home. But it's hard. And I think it does make you realize, hey, every time you eat meat, somebody has had to kill and butcher.
Yeah, and it's you think about the spiritual quality of the animal and the life it's led, and it's particularly its last few hours. And it's interesting to work the continuum. Which of all the meat we eat, Henry, which meat worries the least about the next day or the next moment?
The deer.
Because they spend all year just running around, being deer, and then all of a sudden they walk by a sharpshooting 10 or 11-year-old or 50-year-old, and it's over, just like that. And uh-huh. and what they've been eating has been, you know, what's available to them naturally, and they've been living free. They haven't been inside a fence once. And if they come upon a fence, they jump over it.
Right. Well, it's kind of like squirrels. You started on squirrels, didn't you?
Yeah.
It's the same thing. They're just running up and down trees and having a great time and storing their nuts and having young and then bam.
So, I mean, and that's why, like, that's where hunting ethics comes in. You know, you have to take good shots. Make sure that you have a good shot, because if you wound an animal and then it runs over the hill and valley and suffers and then dies in the woods by itself,
that wasn't a good death.
No, that wasn't a good death, and it didn't really, you know, it probably benefit some coyotes eventually that find it or whatever, but it's the principle behind our hunting is that we take good shots, and then we use all of the animal that we can. The front quarters, which tend to be tougher, we usually cut up for our dogs, and then everything in the back gets made into something that we can eat, from jerky to sushi and everything in between.
Well, I was wondering, when you're hunting deer, are they aware that they're being hunted? Are they frightened and running, or are they just like grazing and they don't even know? Or it could be both?
I mean, it's usually not aware that you're there, but sometimes they are.
Yeah, usually you're just being really quiet in one place, right?
Right. If you're if they're aware of you, you're probably not going to get them, right? Because, like, there's hitting a fast-moving deer with a rifle at distance is it's more of a lucky shot than a, you know, like, it's just really hard to do. Some people will take those shots once in a while, and sometimes they'll hit them. But the basic idea behind how you hunt, how we hunt, is called, like, still hunting, where you're basically going to be quieter than the deer. And you're going to set yourself up, ideally, in a place where your scent is not being blown directly to where they're coming from. And then you can move a little bit, but you're going to move in such a way that so quietly and so slowly that a deer could still approach you and not know you were there.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a deer stand, or could you even describe what that is?
Sure. There's a lot of different kinds of deer stands, and they each speak to the hunter's capability and their ethics. The one that most people use is some sort of ladder stand, where you put it strapped to a tree, and you climb up a ladder, and then you're sitting, usually belted in or strapped in somehow, to a seat, and then the deer comes underneath you and you can shoot it. That's the simplest one. There's also what are called ground blinds, where you're on the ground but you're in some sort of tent or some sort of, like, either built structure or that will hide you and protect you from the weather a little bit. And then there's really big ones where people will build, like, these freestanding structures, like in a field. You probably have seen them once or twice.
Yeah, and they're there year-round, right?
Yeah, they're there year-round. Mm-hmm. And we don't use any of that, partly because we just haven't gotten around to doing it, partly because we're not bow hunters. Almost all the bow hunters hunt out of stands because you need to get a lot closer to the animal to successfully kill it. But we haven't used stands much at all. Mm-hmm. We've had visitors to the farm that had them at times, and I've certainly seen them used. But being on the ground, you're most comfortable and you're the most safe. And there is some seems that you're kind of competing equally with the deer, because they are accustomed to predators on the ground, but they're not really expecting predators from the air too much. Not yet. We'd love to build a treehouse, because we do have bows and we practice with them. but something that was, what I found about the sitting stands, my experience of them is it's, like, very confining and kind of uncomfortable. You're stuck in a position for hours.
Hours? sometimes all day.
Whereas if you had something that was more like a platform in a tree, or like that you could move around slowly, mm-hmm. like a tree house but more open, that's kind of what we envision. And that would be more beautiful too, and something you could use for other things like sleeping up in the tree or whatever.
That'd be fun.
Yeah.
Could we talk just a little bit about guns? And you used a 22 on squirrels.
Right.
And that's what? It's a smaller kind of a gun with a smaller bullet?
Yeah. The bullet's like this long, the actual bullet.
Oh,
like that.
Oh, really?
Big.
Oh,
really
like
small.
Quarter of an inch or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That seems kind of challenging, though, to try to get a squirrel with that. You'd have to be a really good shot, wouldn't you?
It depends how far away the squirrel is.
And
yes, you
not
do.
For...
It's squirrel hunting, I think, is just a wonderful way of teaching people to hunt because it is a hard shot, and you really do have to learn how to like be stealthy and interact with prey. But yeah, the whatever you say, like, it's much more solitary. Squirrel hunting is a long season, and generally it's just like a guy going out and hunting. Whereas deer hunting, gun deer season, it's 9 days, and there's a lot of other people hunting too, and
yeah.
that's part of the drama and the excitement. But it's also another thing to contend with is how other hunters are affecting the deer and moving them. That
oh
kind
yeah.
of thing.
So and 22 probably wouldn't shoot too far away either. I mean, you have when the rifles you use for deer hunting can shoot really far.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're more powerful.
Yes.
Right.
What caliber do you use for your deer hunting, Henry?
A 243, which is like...
And now show me how big that ammunition
like
is.
That big, like how long it is.
An
and
inch,
then like
huh?
this big is how
Yeah,
big.
So there's in the cartridge, or like there's two components, right? There's the bullet itself, a piece of metal that's going to be flung through mm-hmm. the air. And then there's the load behind it, which is the powder.
Oh, that's how
and
the
if you
powder
see that,
gets in.
Right,
yeah.
you see, and there's like little what's something called a cap on the very back of it. So when the hammer goes forward, it hits that cap, makes a tiny explosion, and that ignites the gunpowder, and then that propels the bullet over.
And that makes a big explosion.
I was used to black powder, you know, front mm-hmm. muzzle loading. That's what my husband always did, because we did a lot of rendezvousing. So I
did
saw
he make
that
his
powder.
Own black powder?
Well, he didn't make his own black powder, no. but he packaged it up and stuffed it into the gun, you know,
right.
and it wasn't part of the cartridge. You know,
yes.
it's a different kind of a thing, you know. And then you have the touch hole, and you have a wick, and various things. And we had a cannon, too, same kind of thing. And you'll have to come see our guns sometime. But they're really, I mean, one shot, you know, one shot. I don't know, when you have the guns you use, are they just one shot, or can you shoot multiple times out of one?
Multiple times.
Multiple times.
Oh, okay.
There's a clip. And there's rules around that, too, I think, that limit... Our clips have like four or five that they'll hold,
yeah.
right? But there's a limit for a hunting gun,
mm-hmm.
and hunting guns are also supposed to not to be automatic,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Well, I mean, the 22 has 10 to 30, but...
10 to 30.
That's
oh, really?
Different. Yeah.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's different clips or magazines mm-hmm. that can hold number of bullets, but yeah, most people shoot for the deer, but 243 or 270, which is slightly bigger.
There's all sorts of guns, Dad.
And yeah, there's lots of guns. But
mm-hmm.
and deer hunting is such a popular thing that there's every kind of option
mm-hmm.
out there.
The 7mm, the 6.5. Yeah.
But
there's
I think deer hunting and how it works in our world and in our culture is really fascinating because, you know, we talk about the king's deer. Robin hunting for the king's deer. Well, it's still, that principle still obtains, right? In our, now that the government, the DNR, regulates how we can take the deer, how and when, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in the early, talking to my grandfather who lived, you know, basically all of the 20th century on a farm in the Coulee region, he did not see a deer until he was 50 years old.
Really?
Deer were so scarce because there was not regulation of the hunting. And so they were basically hunted almost to extinction by the 20s, 1920s. Like they, you looked at the deer hunt numbers, some years it was less than 1,000 for the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's hundreds of thousands that we take mm-hmm. in 9 days.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on the one hand, we look at hunting as like this real expression of freedom, like you're going to the woods by yourself mm-hmm. to interact with nature directly and mm-hmm. hopefully shoot a deer. But it's also a heavily regulated activity because it needs to be, or it seemed like people were just too efficient at killing deer, and so mm-hmm. without regulations,
there was and none. You can't just go out and walk on somebody's land and shoot deer. Any old woods, right? That's really regulated, right?
Right. Right. And then that's also an important part of like neighborly relations leading up to gun mm-hmm. deer season. You usually stop by your neighbors and make sure you know kind of where guys are going to be sitting and stuff so that you don't interfere with their hunt or have an unsafe situation. It really seems to work as a regulated activity because now we look and there's, if anything, like too many deer, lots and lots and lots of deer. We see them everywhere. They're getting hit on the road, et cetera.
Yep, we always have lots of deer.
Yeah.
We go down our driveway and they're just, you know, leaping across.
And so the reason I thought it was an interesting topic is to compare that to like beef farming, right? Mm-hmm. Where like, so these beef cattle that we have in the farm, we have to feed them or make sure they're fed or look after them every single day of the year. We have to love them and care for them and make sure that they're well. Whereas the deer, we provide a home for the deer as well on the farm, but we don't have to do anything for them. They just look after themselves. They nibble mm-hmm. in the hayfield at dusk, and they spend most of their time in the woods. And one could go all the way in either direction, right? One could just be a farmer, and you're just always like in equipment and running, making hay, and you have hundreds of cows, or you could be nothing but a hunter and just be always getting ready for that and practice mm-hmm. your bow hunting and shoot 90 a year with your bow, because that's when I went and got tags this year, archery tags and gun tags together, they gave me 9. I could have legally taken 9 deer, and Henry could have taken another
5.
Yeah. Why? That would really feed you for the whole year, wouldn't it?
Certainly. How many did we get?
We got 4, because I shot 2 and Elliot shot 2.
Right.
And you didn't shoot any.
I didn't shoot any. I did a lot of butchering, though, and helping.
Time well, that's not a, that's just the beginning.
Sure enough.
You know, ending their life is just the beginning of a long process then. So.
But I was thinking about this debate or this interplay in human history between, like, the hunting mindset, the hunting slash and then hunting and herding on one side and then farming on the other. They're really quite mm-hmm. different, right? Like with hunting and herding, you're trying to really work with natural processes and observe them. And with farming, you're trying to like make things go your way.
Right, and I'm thinking way back to, well, nomads, people who just didn't even own land.
Right.
They moved with the seasons.
Yeah.
And they were hunters too.
They were. And herders.
Hunters and.
And often herdsmen. Did they have. Sometimes they would take a herd with them.
They were taking a herd with them.
Like, they, certainly, I have not met these people, but I've read a lot about them and seen pictures of the Maasai of East Africa.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of famous for being extremely tall. And part of the reason they're tall is they eat nothing but protein. Like, they travel with their herds all across mm-hmm. grassland, and mm-hmm. almost all of their wealth and all of their livelihood is in these living animals.
Right, right. And they don't have their own land. I wonder what that's like. I mean, it's just a different way of looking at land, like.
A very different way. Yeah. And it certainly bears on both these hunting and farming. Like, with farming, the principal technology of demarcating land is like the fence. Right, you fence between your neighbor and yourself, so your animals stay in your land and his animals stay in his land. But obviously, that also is a useful demarcation when you're hunting. And I will say that right now there's such a demand for hunting land in our area. Like, I have numerous unsolicited calls from people saying, could I lease your land for bow hunting? And I always say, no, we're way too busy out in the woods, you wouldn't be happy hunting here. But But it's really a hot topic right now, like access to land for people because land has grown so expensive.
Well, when I first moved out here, I was from the suburbs in Washington, D.C. I knew nothing about hunting, and I came out here, and people were just mad about hunting. And even little kids littler than you in my daycare center were always talking about hunting and deer and everything. And I was very opposed to it. I thought it was very barbarian, and I didn't like it. And I've really changed my mind about it. And I also realized that hunting land was getting all fenced off and no trespassing and all that kind of thing. And then young men came to ask me if they could use their land and said they had been little boys growing up and they had been able to use that land. And could they hunt on our land now? And I realized, how can I move from the city and say, no, you can't use our land? So, yeah, we have been very selective. We want people that know our property and where we live and where the activity is and where to shoot and where not to shoot. But we have really particularly wanted to accommodate people that grew up in our neighborhood hunting like Henry and not wanting to just shut them off from being able to hunt. So there's all kinds of ways that, like, you can get tax reductions on your woodlands.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can declare to the DNR whether you're going to allow people to hunt there. So some people do accommodate people to hunt.
Yeah, the same with fishing, right? There's certain people that have stream access that they can make that public access while still owning the land, and then they get a reduction on their taxes for that. I've never done it, but I certainly see the signs around. So yeah, I think it's a really, and you think about the rituals of the year, and I mean this gun deer hunting, both is a good thing for protecting the livelihood of the deer, the life, because it happens after they've mated, well before they're going to have their fawns, but it also provides this amazing holiday for the state of Wisconsin. It's like it's a very unifying thing that everyone's doing this activity at the same time,
which is right around Thanksgiving.
Right. And like my friends that live down south, where they have a much longer deer season, it's not the same at all. It's much more of like squirrel hunting or whatever. You kind of go out when you find the time, but there's not this big event that we all get to share together, which I think has great value. There's especially as like the general acceptance of religious holidays is less, so those don't bind people together the way they used to. So having certain rituals that we all do together at the same time, I think it's good for a culture to share things like that.
Well, I'm talking with Lars and Henry Bergen, and we're talking about herding and hunting, and you're listening to Who's in the Kitchen, and I'm Philothea Beeson, and you're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM Community Radio, and you can listen to this show and other shows by going to our website at wdrt.org, Think Dirt Radio. And you can listen to many, many podcasts that we've had on food and farming. And so I think you had mentioned you wanted to talk about Cain and Abel. And how does that fit what we're talking about?
Well, Cain and Abel, most people are probably familiar with who they are. They were the two sons of Adam and Eve. And at some, what we know about Cain, most people, is that he slew his brother. He killed his brother Abel. And so that was like the first sin or the first murder in the Bible. And so that's what most of us know about it. But people don't consider as much why. Why did Cain kill his brother? Do you know?
I think it was jealousy.
Right.
I really should know. Why did he kill his brother? Do you know why, Henry?
No.
Okay.
Well, I'll read from the book, the New Jerusalem Bible, and we'll get a sense. The man, Adam, had intercourse with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. I have acquired a man with the help of Yahweh, she said. She gave birth to a second child, Abel, the brother of Cain. Now Abel became a shepherd and kept flocks while Cain tilled the soil. Time passed, and Cain brought some of the produce of the soil as an offering to Yahweh, while Abel, for his part, brought the firstborn of his flock and some of their fat as well. Yahweh looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but he did not look with favor on Cain and his offering, and Cain was very angry and downcast. Yahweh asked Cain, "Why are you angry and downcast? If you are well disposed, ought you not to lift up your head? But if you're ill disposed, is it not sin at the door like a crouching beast hungering for you, which you must master?" Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let us go out." And while they were in the open country, Cain set on his brother Abel and killed him.
So, I never understood why did God not appreciate the crops as a sacrifice?
Well, there's a book called Ishmael. Have you ever come upon it? It's a novel told from the point of view, or like the expert in the novel is a 400-pound gorilla that's talking to a person, which seems like a crazy setup, but it's a really good book. And in that book, he supposes that this story is told to indicate that God does not prefer the tilling of the soil. He prefers people who work with existing systems, who don't disturb God's creation, but rather work with it. Because obviously tilling the soil is a destructive thing that creates whatever in our world, erosion and soil loss and all these things, whereas herding is the opposite, right? You have your animals on a spot as long as they can subsist there, and then you move along and you move along and you're working with living creatures, and God in the story preferred that. No? I mean, that's...
Well, and so that's the story.
Yes, that's the story. And on my place, I've experienced some of this because we live on a nice hilltop farm in the Driftless region here, and it's pretty hilly. But I was raised... My grandfather was a very, like, successful and skilled dairy farmer, crop man, and I have uncles also who fit that bill. And so when I started farming, I was really wanting to, like, you know, till the soil, like, get benefits of, like, controlling the soil and raising the same crops and all that. Mm-hmm. But then I also went to the organic conference and I heard about this method of rotational grazing, where you keep your land, even your hay fields, in pasture or grass all the time.
Right, because herds can really destroy the land too.
Sure. Anything that's overly intensive and focused on control and like squeezing the last little ounce of something out of the land is eventually becomes harmful, you know? I think so we mainly adopted this rotational grazing thing, and I tried plowing certain things, and what we found with the plowing and partly maybe due to my lack of skill, but also partly the nature of plowing fields in an environment where once in a while you get like a 3 or 4 or 6 inch rain in spring, you can really cause a lot of damage. And we do take soil tests, and I noticed that if we didn't till the soil year after year, we had more organic matter in the soil, which is a like basically the basic test of what your soil can produce and is. Mm-hmm. And we went basically from 1.9% to 6% over the 15 years we've been doing this. The only time that it went backwards was when we tilled the soil.
Does any tilling do that, or is the plow the most damaging?
Well, I mean, I think...
Can you just rotivate and, you know...
Any time you're... So what is the soil, right? It's a composition of matter. It's also like living creatures and beings, fungal networks. Mm-hmm. And when you till it, you liberate a lot of resources for whatever you're going to plant because you kill the weeds, but you also really disrupt the fungal networks and you dry it out and you expose it to the air. So a lot of it is just like the breaking of the soil itself lets off a lot of CO2 because you're opening it up. Otherwise, that would be kept in these relationships between plants and fungus and all that. So, I mean, I think in our situation, because we're pretty steep, I've decided that no tillage is the only thing that works. And the only way to have agriculture production of any kind or food production, if you're not tilling at all, is either there's what's called no-till, which involves poisoning the field first, kill all the weeds, and then planting through that.
No-till has been related to that practice of farming, which isn't better for the land.
I don't think so. I mean, we've always been certified organic, so I haven't had that option anyway.
So how can you not till and actually grow stuff?
Well, you move the cows. On our place, we've got fencing and set up so we can move the cows probably across the farm five times, five full circuits in the summer. Mm-hmm. And we make hay from certain fields to have fodder in the winter. And we produce, you know, not enough to feed everybody, but certainly to feed ourselves and a couple dozen other families with beef throughout the year.
So you're not growing corn and soybeans?
None of it. It keeps our inputs to nearly zero. We're not buying seed. We're not buying fertilizer. We're buying just enough diesel to make hay or move bales around. And you also, as a farmer, you have much more freedom to take your crop when you want it. Rather, like when you send the animals to slaughter is when you get them, but they'll live until then. Whereas with row crops, like you're getting your crop when everyone else is.
Right.
And so you're kind of stuck with that arrangement.
I always wondered when I came out here learning about farming, why everybody had to own their own equipment. And then you find out, well, we're all harvesting at the same time, and so you can't share the equipment because we all need it at the same time.
Well, and that's the other thing that we really, this is a profound statement on like how you share things and how that works. We borrow our small baler every year from the neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always a nice interaction, you know, like it's a chance to see your neighbor. And then we work with another family. For us, we have basically four of us out there. And making hay was always super stressful because I had to like get a crew together to come from town at a particular time to like help us move bales around. And that never seemed to work out. We'd have a breakdown at the wrong time, or the hay would dry too slow or something, and then you have a bunch of people standing there waiting for action. But 4 years ago, did we start with the Bendels?
I think it was five now.
5 years. Anyway, we met a local, like some neighbors who had several kids and had animals and had a need for some hay right around the corner, and we said, hey, let's do this hay on shares. We'll supply the land and the equipment, and you guys supply as much labor as we need, and at the end of the year, we'll split the crop.
Yeah.
And you think, well, that's like a lot of your crop to give away. No, I mean, that you had before. But come to find out, because with all this help and being able to do things at the right time and with the right spirit, we have wound up with the same amount of hay as we always made. And they get the same amount too. So like just the act of like generosity and working with your neighbors just expands the resource so much. Mm-hmm. And now we've been able to rent some land down by them. So I think it's a real issue in the countryside is the equipment always pushes you towards like everyone own their own thing and be in debt and be on their own. But I think it used to be, and it could be again, that people are much more
communal. Of rotate around, and people help on one farm, and then they help on another farm,
right?
Kind of thing. Yeah.
And it's a fun thing to do together, and you're not alone in it, and you're also not financially as exposed because you get this whole line of rusting equipment that you need to pay for. Mm-hmm. So I think it's that is in our world, rotational grazing is a fantastic method of building the soil, making things beautiful, because it's always green all year round too. Mm-hmm. It's like there's never a moment like right now where like all of the crop fields are kind of gray and dead.
Yeah.
Right? Nothing's growing until the time that they put the corn seed or the soybean seed in the ground. Whereas with our stuff is greening up right now already. And so I think, again, for our peasant subsistence family, this is a great way to make the land mm-hmm. productive and make it more productive every year. And also, it's super resilient to weather. Like, there's very few weather things that can really damage us. We're not going to have erosion from flooding. And because you have those deep permanent roots in the ground, your hay fields are much more resistant to drought than any row crop could be.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, you know, now we're learning that beef, or really, you know, just the dairy animals really are not made to eat corn and soybeans anyway.
No.
They really are made for grazing.
Right, and there's all these debates about, like, the climate or the environment and how these different creatures affect the environment. And obviously it affects, like, how you treat the creature and how they're living. If a dairy animal is living indoors and eating nothing but a high energy corn diet all day long, they're going to produce a manure that smells a certain way, and they're going to produce a lot of it, and it's going to drop on concrete and then go into some big slurry pit, and that's all, like, a process that's, like, fairly stinky and kind of concentrates manure in. Whereas my cows, 11 months out of 12, are out, have access to pasture, and when they poop, it's going right onto grass where it's immediately getting recycled back into the ground.
Yeah.
And they're eating a grass-based diet, so they smell a lot different from the beginning. So,
and doesn't that contribute also, the confinement, contribute to E. coli and different kinds of bacterial infections?
Yes. I don't know as much about that, but you certainly hear about it. And, I just think that that system is targeting one thing, is like max production of gallons of milk per day, and all the other things are secondary to that. Whereas on our place, we really try and consider the beauty of the land, the health of the animals, the way it feels to live on it as a person. And also I have an off-the-farm job, so creating systems that are relatively, like, don't need hours and hours of someone's labor mm-hmm. every day to function properly.
Mm-hmm. Do you have to go out several times a week and move the fence? Or you don't move the fence, you just move the herds to different paddocks?
You run a new fence, and yeah, like, so in there's more work in the summer because you're making usually a new pasture every day and then moving them into that. But it's also really, so like, what kind of work do you want to do? Like, it's mainly walking, super pleasant, easy on your body, easy on your mind, easy on the cows. There's no, like, pushing them because they're always wanting you to walk into this new pasture. And then in the winter, we feed hay once or twice a day. And once in a while, I have to buy some hay from my neighbor if we run short. Right now, we're in that situation because, yeah, just the farmers are always optimistic mm-hmm. and they always think their hay is going to last a little bit longer mm-hmm. than it does. But, and then, yeah, there's the pieces of, like, butchering or getting it to the butcher and getting it back, all that. That's part of, like, making a product for the public to use. You know, you have to get it butchered or do it yourself.
So are we going to talk about a little bit about butchering or not?
Yes. Let's talk about the two, because we butcher deer together, right, Henry?
Yeah.
Can you describe the process?
What do you mean by the process?
Well, how does it go? Like, from the moment we shoot a deer, how do we get it from there to the point where we can eat it?
In five words or less.
Well, first you, like, gut it in the woods, and then you come and get it with, like, the ranger or whatever. And then you usually hang it up for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you skin it first?
No. Generally not.
Yeah. For, like,
and you hang it up which way? The head up or down?
Both.
We've done either.
Oh, there's not a wrong way.
Right.
Because we did it wrong one time.
Yeah, my Uncle Vince likes to do them head up. I usually do them feet up. But because it's really about how you're going to skin it. You know, you're going to skin it usually in the mm-hmm. same mm-hmm. place and position where it's mm-hmm. being hung.
And are you trying to save the hide?
Sometimes. Like, yeah, we were trying to save them, but, like, yesterday our dog dragged out both of them.
Oh.
So that didn't work so well.
Yeah, it's really, that's, I would say, in all impeccability, we haven't done as well at that as we've done at using the rest of the animal.
Mm-hmm. But you'll have a chance to do that. I mean, that's another whole thing.
Oh, yeah. I met a guy last night that was knew all about it. And we've taken cowhides to a certain point, but there's a lot of steps to it, and there's a lot of decisions to make, and that's something that we're still learning how to do, but it's certainly an aspiration. We obviously, if you get a nice big buck, we keep the head with the horns on it because it's great decor for the house and a memory of a moment.
It's actually
But that one's not very big.
That one's not too big.
Except it was easy to access.
So I'm just going to interrupt into a little station ID, and I'm talking to Lars and Henry Bergen. They're from the Westby,
town of Clinton,
Bloomingdale area.
Yeah.
And so we're talking about herding and hunting, both raising your own herd animals and also hunting, especially talking about deer hunting. And you're listening to WDRT 91.9, and this is Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson, and Henry was just telling us what you do. Okay, you have killed the deer, and you brought it in, and you're hanging it. You've gutted it in the woods, and you're hanging it. Now, what is the idea of hanging? Can you just cut it up right away, or is there a purpose in hanging for a day or two or a week or what?
It makes it more tender, usually, if you hang it. And does it taste better, or is it just more tender?
Well, both. But I mean, certainly it's hard to separate the two, you know, tenderness from flavor. But we find generally our ritual is like we shoot most of the deer the first weekend of the season, and then we'll butcher them the second weekend. So 4 or 5, 6 days.
And
later.
That season is usually pretty chilly, which is nice because then you hang the deer. Mm-hmm. You know, if you get a 70-degree day, that's not really too good.
Yeah, if it's really warm, you'll do it faster.
Mm-hmm. So then you have a carcass that has been skinned.
Uh-huh. And then you take it inside somewhere and, like, cut off all the meat that you're going to use, which is usually the legs and, the meat on the back.
So how do you cut it? With a saw?
No, with a knife usually. You just take out the meat with a knife.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we call it, I mean, we do that.
Boning it out.
Boning it out where you... Usually what we'll do is we'll take the back straps off, you know, the loin pieces along the spine as a whole piece, two of them, and then we'll take the back legs off and bring those indoors.
And the front legs for the dogs.
Yeah, and the front legs we take off too, and then we'll, in the warmth of the kitchen with cutting board and stuff, we'll process the back legs and the loins for human consumption.
And dog food for Blue, the front legs.
And then because we eat a lot of our venison raw, we like to be particularly picky about like quality, so the dogs will get probably by weight half of the meat when all is said and done, but it's obviously
not about quite half, but
well, do you test that, you send that meat off for testing?
We don't.
Mm-hmm. You know that your herds are is not for your raised cattle. I was thinking of the deer at that time, but
right. I mean, and just I did enough research when this thing was first being discussed, and
CWD.
Yes,
chronic wasting disease.
In the history of the state of Wisconsin, not a single person has contracted CWD from eating deer.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are really interested in testing things in general, but that's a whole discussion about the modern scientific mindset. And the value of cutting your deer's head off and sending it in. Some people think that's really good to do.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do it. If a deer looks really sick, then you wouldn't want to eat it. Same with a cow. Like if we have a cow that gets bloat and dies, which is not really related to their general health, we'll butcher that. But if a cow is sick for 2 weeks and then dies, we just drag it off. You know, like it's, you don't want to eat. Unhealthy animals.
Right.
So if an animal didn't look good, we wouldn't. And also you don't cut into the spine, you don't cut into the skull, because that's where the prions exist, is in the nervous system. So,
but you do take off the tenderloins and things like that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
They come from on each side of the spine?
Yes, just like just like butchering your sheep. I mean, it's really, if you've butchered sheep, deer are pretty similar. Mm-hmm. You know, like a mm-hmm. big buck will be bigger than maybe a sheep, yeah. but.
Well, now we're talking about butchering deer. Mm-hmm. But do you ever butcher your own cattle? Have you ever done it?
Yeah. We do it like 3 or 4 times a year.
Really?
Yeah, it's a big
They're
project.
Huge.
It's huge. Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're 1,000 pounds.
Absolutely. Like hanging yeah. weight, yeah, most of ours at the butcher is like 700 to 800. So yeah, it's a massive undertaking to me. I mean, I've got friends who are a little bit more capable at it, so I always get someone else involved. But it's also really cool if you want to understand your meat on a granular level and get it cut exactly the way you're going to want to use it as mm-hmm. a cook. Mm-hmm. That's the way to yeah. do it. But it takes. Mm-hmm. We don't really have the right indoor space for it either. We have a big pole shed that's not heated, and where we're doing a lot of other things that aren't like, you know, food grade.
Food related. Right. I've seen some of the butchering stuff that's been done, like in Europe, and you go, oh my, the conditions are just amazing. Not really stainless steel, you know, washed down, sanitized.
Yeah. We talk about what kind of structure, building a little timber frame structure that was like for maple syrup production and butchering would be pretty amazing, but George Seaman, you know George.
Yes.
Used to talk about certain farmers building themselves out of a nice place to live. And I'm highly aware of that. As a, like, there's always the temptation to add another building because you have this other thing you want to do, but the building is there forever. You know, and you, so far we've opted to not, you know, have a special butcher place, and we kind of work around the seasons mm-hmm. and like mm-hmm. we usually slaughter our own hogs, but we do that, you know, in the fall, and then we have a friend who has mm-hmm. a better setup, so mm-hmm. we'll take the halves over to him and then we'll slice them up there. Mm-hmm. So there's, again, if you involve your neighbors and your friends and their tools, you
also can, with the Bendels, same neighbors.
Yeah, the same neighbors that make hay with are also our butchering pals, and they have a nice meat grinder.
Not yes, for the pigs, nice. But...
And also, I should, you know, like, on shows, people come on with, like, sometimes a new project. We have one new project with these friends of ours, the Bendels, and it's a biochar company.
Oh.
And I'm just putting it out there to those Cooley Region listeners, mm-hmm. Driftless Region listeners, that, like, mm-hmm. if you want biochar for both cooking or for mm-hmm. soil amendment or for odor control with your animals... or any number of other purposes, water filtration. We are the first biochar producer in the state of Wisconsin. We're using 100% clean wood waste from the Amish mills. And so if you are interested in that, we should be at the farmer's market, but you could also just give us a call and come find us, because it's a wonderful new product available in the
Yes,
in
well,
the
I should tell you about John Gibbs. He did this a few years ago in North Crawford. And he was selling biochar.
Really?
Yes. So you'd love to talk with him. He was on my show too, and we talked
no
about.
No kidding. Is he still
about,
doing it?
Barbecuing an animal under the ground, making under, you know, ground pit.
Is he still doing it?
He isn't doing it anymore. Huh. But he was the first person I ever heard about. You know, but there's so many uses for charcoal. I mean, it's
so
just
so many.
Oh my gosh! So that's another whole show
for your belly, all this stuff.
Oh,
and
gosh,
when we
yeah.
do that, I should have Jordan come in with me, because he's been the one running the kiln more than. But we built ours. We had the Amish neighbor. We designed something. The Amish neighbor built it, and we've been refining it. And we can. It recycles all the gases being driven off from the stuff being charred, and that is burned to fuel the process. And it's,
oh my gosh,
it's really an How inspiring and cool thing, and something that both should allow us to build our soil, use an unutilized resource, and
we've got a lot of wood waste.
We sure do, especially, waste. I mean, there's maybe like 15 sawmills in our township, like a lot, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We have so many projects that use wood with the Bendels.
it's a very good place
Me
to be.
Me and Judah are making like cutting boards and birdhouses and all sorts of stuff.
Oh, really? Yeah.
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 Well, you guys have so many projects, you could just stop working and just stay home and do stuff, right?
Yeah.
There's not enough definitely. Hours in the day for right. all your ideas. I wanted to go back to the idea of eating some raw meat. Now, you don't mean just eating it raw. You cure.
No.
No, you no. do you eat from me?
Yeah, so everyone's familiar with this, the concept of sushi, right? Sushi is like you take strips of usually fish, raw fish, and you wrap them up with rice and different vegetables to mm-hmm. create like a delicious mm-hmm. Little bite. And my friend Adrian Hugo long ago is like talking about eating venison raw, and I was like, no kidding, we should try mm-hmm. sushi. Mm-hmm. And that was years ago, and like it is a family staple. We recently had Henry's birthday party, 11 years old, and there was a dozen kids there, and we all had venison sushi as our meal.
Yeah, I've had that for like 2 or 3 years though.
At birthday, yeah. It's a hit mm-hmm. because and it's very similar. That's why you want your venison tender, and you obviously pick the nicest parts, and you trim it again when you're making it, because you want to make sure that 100% of the meat that goes in that sushi has really not been exposed to the air before you put it in there, so it can't have any like bacterial growth or whatever.
Yeah, and it was super clean processing.
Yeah, and you've processed mm-hmm. it yourself, so you know which. You know what? Mm-hmm. What? How it was done, and
yeah. Sometimes you just put a bunch of salt on it, and it's just good by itself.
Yeah, or you can poach it in like a mixture of like lime juice and tamari, and then that does kind of cook it.
Oh, like ceviche.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So it is. Is it just purely raw, or is it a little bit cured?
It's purely raw.
No. Okay.
We've done those other things, to, mm-hmm. but they all seem to make it less good. And
well, that's amazing. That's really amazing. But you also have done your own prosciutto.
Yeah.
That's all really raw.
Yeah, but that's all about time and salt.
Dried and salted and all that stuff.
Yeah, you also did jerky.
Yeah, we really went on a jerky kick for a while because we got a pellet smoker from Nelson's. And that really makes jerky making way, way, way easier because you can just set a temperature and you're smoking it at the same time and it dries it out so nice and it's so delicious.
Is it electric?
Yeah, it's electric.
And then you feed pellets into it to smoke it.
Yeah, pellets are the fuel, and it's got a little electric hookup for the controls and the little, like, it's got a little auger that augers in pellets to keep it at whatever temperature you want. But yeah, we did lots of venison. One of our friends shot one of the big deer, and we wanted to mail him some meat, and you can't really, it's hard to mail dripping meat or even frozen meat, but it's easy to mail jerky.
Oh yeah.
And it's kind of the same principle in a way behind using biochar as fuel. It's a way of like saving all what is essential to make that food but driving out all the moisture so you can keep it forever, or you can ship it to your friend in South Carolina.
Well, I hate to say that we are out of time.
Can you believe it?
Can we have that continue in another day?
For sure.
There's so much more to talk about, and I've loved having Lars and Henry Bergen on the show. And we have to cut it short because the time says, you know.
How long have you been on the air, Philothea?
15 years.
Wow. That's fantastic.
A show a week for 15 years. I mean, you do the math.
That's a lot.
It's a lot of guests, but I have enjoyed having you every time. It's always stimulating and interesting. And so thank you for listening. And you've been listening to Who's in the Kitchen on WDRT. And tune in again next week, every Saturday at noon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.